Session number 13152, Rule 6.
Wing Commander Parrish, Rule 6.
Right. Close support controlled bombing of in support of the army was much more interesting, because occasionally you would even get a photograph of your target. We had one in 10,000 maps, I think it was, or one in 50,000, or both. Very large-scale maps, anyway, which on which you could identify buildings, bridges, small targets, quite small targets you could be sure of finding. And the navigation to them was surprisingly not all that difficult. We'd have one flight, six aircraft, going down on one of these pinpoint targets. They were probably artillery control posts or known regimental headquarters, that sort of thing. And the technique was, again, you came round to about 5,000 feet and circled the target and aimed to come in out of sun, which would dazzle any gunners on the ground, in a 60-degree dive, with the putting the gun sight on the dot on the gun sight on the target at that angle, and then at about 2,000 feet, you would start pulling out of the dive, count 1, 2, 3, and press the bomb button, and away it went. And it's surprising, on quite a lot of occasions, we really hit the target. Direct hits were not frequent, but very close misses were often achieved. And then you stayed down on the deck until you got out of that particular area and reassembled your other chaps. The fellows behind, I was always asking them what the results were from the aircraft in front of them, but I think we came down so quickly and were passed before the first bomb had gone off by the time the last chap came down. We had no casualties on that at all, as far as I remember. There was an almost complete lack of German aircraft at this stage. I think I only saw one from Riccione, and that was a very, very fast twin-engined Messerschmitt, much more advanced, which was a reconnaissance aircraft, and it went straight over the top of our living quarters at Riccione at about 50 feet, I should think, or less, going northwards. There was no point in trying to take off after that. just the single one. And then, of course, in February, I was relieved and promoted to be an acting wing commander, and went to go up to Desert Air Force headquarters. Actually, there's a funny story about that. The commander-in-chief... Oh, God, I've forgotten the names. Isn't it ridiculous how names go? Switch it off for a moment. I'll have to... the commander-in-chief of the Mediterranean Allied Air Forces, who was our supreme boss in Italy, came up to have lunch with the group captain commanding the wing, and he asked for the four squadron commanders to be present at lunch, so he'd like to meet them. Which he did, and he had a word with each of us. And then we had lunch, and he was talking to the group captain and other people, and we were... I would say we were ignored, but he didn't talk to us anymore anyway. He'd done his stuff with us. And we went off back to our squadrons. The next thing was that I was talking to the group... talking to somebody, I've forgotten who it was now. I don't think it was the group captain. It might have been the senior admin officer or somebody. He said, do you know you're in the hot seat, Peter? And I said, no, what's the hot seat for? And he said, well, when the chief got back to headquarters at Caserta, he sent a signal to Pussy Foster, who was the AOC of Desert Air Force at that time, saying, on a recent visit to your to 324 wing, I was most impressed with Squadron Leader Parrott. Have him made a wing commander as soon as possible. Which I thought was a very strange thing, because I swear blind that he got me mixed up with the CO 111 squadron, who was a splendid chap named Humphreys or something like that. Humphreys, I think, yeah. Anyway, the next step was a signal to me telling me to report to number one R&R, Zara. Z-A-R-A. I thought, Zara? I don't know what Zara is, you see, and I didn't know the hell it was. And eventually I had to go along to wing headquarters and find out what Z-A-R-A was. And the group captain came out and he said, oh, I've seen that signal. You don't want to go to Zara, do you? I said, well, where is it, sir? And he said, it's an island off the Yugoslav coast. And I said, no, I don't. And so that was scrapped. And a few days later, I got another posting. I went up to Desert Air Force headquarters as Wing Commander, training of fighters.
There's one final thing that I'd like us to cover, if we could, please, and that is the crisis in the Middle East after the war in, I think, 58.
Oh, yes.
Over Jordan and Lebanon.
Yes.
Can you tell me what part you played in that, please?
Well, I was the Wing Commander flying at Nicosia and second in command of the station. We had our own fighter squadron there, which was the resident fighter squadron for the Middle East. We had a squadron of Hastings, transport squadron of Hastings, who also carried the parabattalions about when they wanted it. We had a station flight and a helicopter squadron, which also played with the army and did search and rescue. There was also a search and rescue element in the Hastings squadron. They could drop a boat out to sea and various other things. There was always something going on. When I arrived out in 1958, there were large detachments of aircraft, other aircraft from England, a section of Beverleys, there were some extra Hastings, and so, well, at one stage, we got to having five fighter squadrons on the station, four others apart from our own resident one. One of which was one of the visitors was the Meteor Night Fighter Squadron. The next thing was we got even more reinforcements, and we had 12 Beverleys. Well, I'll cut it short. We had 180 aircraft on the airfield, which was also the civil airport for the island. So they had to have parking space as well, which was difficult at times. We had to close one runway to make parking space. To making up that 180 aircraft were a contingent of 18 C-118s of the US Air Force and huge aircraft, huge transport aircraft of the Americans. And the parachute battalion was launched from Nicosia to Amman in Jordan to support King Hussein. The Americans, in the meantime, were going over the beaches of Lebanon, of Beirut, frightening the bikini-clad ladies a bit, I think. And then we carried on. All the supplies were flown in from Nicosia to Amman and to the Lebanon for the Americans. So it was a pretty busy time. The civil aviation continued as normal. At the same time, the EOCA affair was going on the island itself. So altogether, it was a very, very operational and warlike time. But it was a very successful operation indeed. But there was always something going on in the Middle East, which you're on alert for.
Did you ever get any attempts by Iorka to attack the airbase or the planes?
Oh, yes. They had been attacked once, on the base, before I arrived, and they damaged an aircraft in the aircraft park, one of the aircraft parks. And then while I was in the, while I was there, I was standing in my office, which was in the control tower, and had a marvellous view of the whole of the airport. And there was suddenly the most tremendous bang. And I looked out of the window, and I misjudged the direction. My ears misled me. I looked to the east first of all, because I thought that was where the noise had come from, and then I turned around slowly, and then I saw the black smoke to the west, right next to a comet which was staging through. The bomb had been put in the... funnily enough, this was at the end of the emergency, because the fighter squadrons were going home, the visiting ones, the fighter squadron was going home, and that's why the comet was there. It was taking some of the ground crew back of one of the fighter squadrons. The engineering officer of that squadron, who was going on the airplane, had packed his bag in his room in the mess, and he had left it open and gone down to have lunch. Well, no, I think he'd probably closed it up, closed the bag up. Anyway, he went down to have lunch and presumably did not look again, check his bag, and took it up and put it on the ground with the rest of the baggage to be loaded onto the aircraft. And the bomb had been put in there during the lunch period by one of the employees, one of the Greek employees on the station. The result with that was that all the civilian Greeks were banished from the station for quite a long time. During that time, of course, we were very often confined to camp for a period of several days or weeks. And then, of course, once you went out, once the thing was over, we could go out in safety. But during the Iorka period, if you were going off camp, you carried a revolver, a loaded revolver, with you. I remember taking my wife down shopping in Nicosia. She wanted to go to a dress shop, and I can remember now standing outside that damn shop with my hand on my gun and my back to the show window while she was looking at the dresses. But to her credit, my car, I'd bought a new car, of course, going abroad, and it arrived, and I picked it up after it had been repaired from a few dents incurred on the being taken off the ship, probably by Iorka. And this was one of our first sorties out of camp. My wife came out and put a pair of scissors on the shelf in front of her. And I looked at those and I said, and I got my gun, you see. And I looked at her and I said, what are those for? And there's I said, you don't do any sewing in the car. You haven't got any sewing with you anyway. She looked at me and she said, they're to protect you. So the women were taking a part as well.
How unsafe at all did you feel in Nicosia?
Oh, very, very unsafe. You didn't hang around. Didn't hang around at all. But for the first 10 days, we were confined to the camp. Although my family had come out with me. There was a bit of argument about that, but eventually they did let me take them out. They had to go and stay in a boarding house in Kyrenia because I couldn't have the Mary Quarter on the station until the outgoing incumbent had left. Not 10 days, about a week, maybe. which they thoroughly enjoyed, of course, because they were not at the mercy, really at the mercy of Ioka. They could go on the beach and enjoy the sun and sand. In 1959, a Star Tudor belonging to Skyways crashed on the top of Mount Supan, a 14,000-foot high mountain in eastern Turkey. It was carrying half a dozen or so guided missiles, which were on their way to the test range at Woomera in Australia. The powers that be were extremely concerned about this because Mount Supan is less than 100 miles from the Russian border, and they were understandably worried that the Russians could mount an expedition to go and see what they could find of these secret weapons. In the ordinary run of things, whoever had been crashed up there, number 70 Squadron with their Hastings would have gone up to do the search for the crash and possible survivors. In this case, it took them a week because Mount Supan was always covered by a cloud. It's a special name for the cloud, and I can't remember what it is now. And they could never quite cover the whole of the top of the mountain. The Turks were very good. The aircraft were based in eastern Turkey and flew out as often as they could. At that time, of course, we didn't know that the aircraft was on the mountain. They searched for a week. It's a very mountainous area. They searched for a week without success. And the Turks said, "You're not going to find it, and we must now cease our support. You must go back to Cyprus." And one fellow, flying officer, George Noble, captain of one of the Hastings, he was convinced that the aircraft had crashed on that particular mountain. And he got permission on the last day. They had to be out by 12 o'clock on a Wednesday. And he got permission to go off at dawn, or slightly before dawn, in fact, to do one final search at the top of the mountain. He got out there. The cloud at that time of the morning had not had time to form. It's a convection cloud, isn't it? And he searched the top of the mountain, which was a crater about a mile and a half across, I should think, of an extinct volcano, and very tumbled, and he spotted the tail of the Star Tudor. Later that day, a Turkish Air Force major at that time, commanding a reconnaissance squadron, went out. He was flying one of the American fighter jets, but they had a backward-facing camera, so that he dived down over the mountain and then went up vertically, taking photographs of the top of the mountain with a rearward-facing camera. The pictures came out marvellously and showed clearly the tail. The next step was to send the mountain rescue team up there. We had a mountain rescue team at Nicosia with a full-time flight sergeant in charge of it, at least the senior NCO, and one of the flight lieutenants in the Hunter Squadron, 208 Squadron, Dickie Robertson, was the commander of the search and rescue outfit. There were 18 of them. The Turks gave us permission for them to go, and off they went in two Hastings, a couple of jeeps and trailers, and were met at Diyarbakir, which is where the aircraft was stationed later on, and landed there to find a company of Turkish infantry to escort them into the area and up to the mountain. which again was over a day's travel, I think. Very rough terrain. Anyway, they arrived and they set up camp at 8,000 feet, which was just below the snow line. There were villages at that height, incidentally, on this mountain. It's quite a big one. They were rather puzzled by the large amount of army who were taking them for security, they thought, when they were told by the colonel commanding this lot that it was very dangerous around there, because not only were the Kurds disaffected and liable to attack the army, but also the villagers weren't very pleasant either. Something else comes later about that, about the villagers. The snow line was about 8,000 feet. None of them had ever climbed higher than, I think, about 6,000 or 7,000 feet or 8,000 feet. One had been up to 10,000. But here they were faced with going up to 14,000 feet. And so they started. They sent up, Dickie Robinson did it very well. He sent up a section of two in the first place. And they got so far and couldn't get any farther, they came back and said, look, sir, we need crampons. By this time, I was up in Diyarbakir with the Hastings, not flying it myself, the 70 Squadron crew, but I was organising what was going on. And they were asking for supplies, and here came this request for crampons. This I signalled back to Nicosia, and I think not more than 36 hours later, crampons appeared on a Canberra. We put them into a parachute container and dropped them to the chaps on the mountain. I found out later that one of the search and rescue people at the Air Ministry had spent most of a day going round the various suppliers of crampons in London to get enough for them. And they'd been flown out from London that quickly. I have to cut this story short, but the next request was for some rifles. and this I queried with Dickie, and he said, well, we've been told it's very dangerous on the mountains because of the bears and the wolves. And indeed, one pair of people actually did see a bear and had to hide behind a rock in the snow before it went away. It was a brown bear, apparently, with a cub. A very nasty moment. Anyway, the rest of the chaps were with their crampons now got up to the top of the mountain, and they started collecting up the debris and the unfortunate occupants of the aircraft, of course. There were two complete crews, incidentally, so, on the aircraft. So I think it was 12 people who were killed. They collected up the bodies, tried to find the valuables of the people, the wristwatches and wallets and that sort of thing, and they weren't there. They couldn't find any. Anyway, they collected up the bodies and put a cairn over it. And by this time, I'd established that the only way that the thing could be made safe from the Russians was to have all the pieces which were scattered all over the top of the mountain of the missiles, the load which was being carried, to assemble them into piles and to blow them up. In the meantime, the people who had done the undertaker's work came back now and reported the lack of personal belongings, and Dickie Robinson went along. Oh, and they'd also found footprints up there. It was obvious that some of the peasants living on the mountain had already been up to the top to see what there was. And so Dickie Robinson went along to the colonel of the Turkish infantry and explained about the belongings which presumably had been taken or stolen by these people in their villages. And the Turkish colonel took note and said he'd see what he could do. And in the meantime, I was getting two parachute loads of parachute container loads of explosives, which came up in a Hastings, and in a Canberra, with an armament officer who sat down in the little office that the Turks had given me, and wrote out instructions on how to use the explosives on foolscap paper, which was then sellotaped to the outside of these parachute containers. He took a long time and did it very carefully and correctly, so that these chaps wouldn't hurt themselves, because some of them were electronic detonators. And so off they went, and we dropped these two things on the mountain. Unfortunately, they only got one of the containers. The second one was dropped short. However, two airmen, one an instrument fitter, and the other, I think, an airframe fitter, between them gathered up all these pieces of equipment, and they made a note of every single reference number they could find, or serial number, which they could find on those crates or on the open pieces of machinery. And it was some list. And they proceeded to blow them up. Unfortunately, Dickie Robertson's camera was also blown up at one stage because they forgot to take it off the top of the pile. Nevertheless, I believe he got some photographs out of it. At one stage, the Turkish Air Force provided a helicopter which landed with great difficulty on the top of the mountain and with even more great difficulty managed to get off again. He was a wise chap because he landed very close to the edge of the ridge of the crater, and in fact he had to move forward on the ground and sort of hurl himself into space because he couldn't get enough lift to raise the aircraft off the ground at that height. A very hairy exercise, but a useful one. He took some. He may have even taken those two chaps up there, I'm not sure. While that was going on, the Turkish colonel had been doing his stuff around the villages, and he came back with a considerable number of rings and jewellery and watches, wallets, handbags, which he handed over to Dickie Robertson, of course. And Dickie said, "Good Lord, how did you get this?" And he said, "Well, we went round the villages and saw the headmen, and we had to cut off a couple of hands to make them deliver, but they did it in the end." But that was a very successful exercise on the part of the Nicosia Rescue Team, for which Dickie Robinson got an MBE, and others were also decorated.